Good day.
Today is Wednesday, 22nd July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, over the course of my programme yesterday, I suggested that in the political battle between the former Ukrainian Defence Minister, Mykhailo Fyodorov, and the commander, the military commander of the Ukrainian military, Alexander Sirsky, it looked as if Sirsky had won, and he seemed, or so it seemed to be me yesterday, as if he would be firmly in, he would remain firmly in place. After all, he had the full support of the entire military leadership of Ukraine. Every general spoke out in support of him in relation to the conflict with Defence Minister Fyodorov. The view that Sirsky expressed, that Fyodorov's great drone offensive was not achieving the results that Fyodorov claimed, and that the situation on the front lines was becoming increasingly difficult, and that Ukraine needed to mobilise more troops and needed to intensify mobilisation, seemed to be widely accepted within the army. And, well, despite some articles appearing in the Western media over the weekend calling for Sirsky to go, it looked as if he'd seen off this pressure, and the last word I heard about him yesterday was that he'd returned to his command post somewhere in the Donbass, where he'd published a supposedly conciliatory but in actual fact rather defiant statement addressed to the former defence minister, Mykhailo Fyodorov. Well, that was yesterday. Just a few hours after I made my programme, the announcement came from Zelensky himself that he decided to sack Sirsky and Gnatov, the chief of the general staff, and he has appointed in Sirsky's place General Drapaty, who, as I understand it, commands Ukraine's ground forces, and who could be described as the one senior commander within the Ukrainian military who was less supportive of General Sirsky than the others. And another officer has been appointed to command the general staff, no doubt one of General Drapaty's acolytes. And from what I understand, this person comes from the Ukrainian paratroop forces, and I'm not sure that he's what his background altogether is and why he's considered to be the suitable person to run the general staff, but doubtless he is an ally and sympathizer of General Drapaty. Now, here I'm going to just take a step back and make a very simple observation. Over the last few months, since late winter, we have been hearing in the West a consistent narrative about Ukrainian success. Ukrainian success in the sky with Ukraine's drone offensive against Russia, and success on the ground with Ukraine successfully taking back the initiative on the ground and even regaining territory from Russia. Well, if things are going so well, why has the defence minister and now the chief military officer, the overall military commander and his chief of staff, why have they all been sacked in this way? Surely, if things are going well, you stick with a winning team. Could it be that the reason they've all been sacked is because in reality things aren't going so well? That the war in the sky is not achieving the objectives that Zelensky and his Western backers imagined, that it has indeed proved to be a massive diversion of resources, which has drained resources from other areas of the Ukrainian military system without repaying the enormous investment that has been made in it. And could it be that General Sirski's military successes on the battlefronts have been mostly imaginary? Well, I would say, obviously, yes to both. If we talk about the drone offensive, see what it has now become reduced to. It started with a campaign to cut the Novorossiya highway. For a time, we got all sorts of pictures and films of motor vehicles being destroyed on the highway as they were traveling from Russia to Crimea. There was a lot of excitement about it. We don't hear much about the Novorossiya highway anymore. And the reason, no doubt, is the one that Governor Balitsky of Zaporozhye region gave to Putin, that the Russian military has secured the Novorossiya highway, and that road traffic has returned to something like normal as one would expect of a highway that remains vulnerable and relatively close to the front lines. And then we had the attacks on the refineries, and well, this has attracted a huge amount of attention. In the Daily Telegraph yesterday, the journalist Ambrose Evans-Pritchard claimed that the refineries had been 50% degraded in Russia. An absurd figure, by the way. Another figure that I received from a private source who's done some analysis on it says that he believes that the refining capacity has been reduced by around 25%, and he provided me with the methodology whereby he came to that conclusion. My own view is that that is also almost certainly going to prove to be an overestimate, a very considerable overestimate. But that is my view, and I'm not going to say that this wasn't a careful study, because it was. So, a drone offensive against the refineries, except we aren't hearing much about that anymore, and nobody's explaining why. The attacks on the refineries appear to have stopped. If you're going to attack refineries, then of course the Russians will work to repair them. Surely you need to keep the attacks on the refineries ongoing all the time to prevent the repairs being completed. Just say. Well, we don't hear much about attacks on refineries anymore. In fact, that appears to have stopped. There appear to have been attacks on other oil holding facilities, but not on refineries themselves. I suspect that the Russians have also now established strong defences around their refineries, and the Ukrainians have, in fact, attempted to attack them, but that the attacks overall have been unsuccessful. So, we don't hear much about attacks on the refineries anymore. And today, Putin once again had a meeting with the economic bloc of his government, and he said that problems with the internal fuel situation in Russia would be temporary and would be soon resolved. And this follows shortly after statements by the Russian deputy prime minister in in charge of the fuel energy complex, Alexander Novak, who says that across most of the country now, the fuel situation has stabilized. And also, and finally, from the Speaker of the Russian Parliament, Volodin, who also says essentially the same thing. That doesn't mean that there aren't still fuel shortages in some places. Crimea, in particular, I suspect, continues to be very vulnerable. But overall, across the vast territory of the Russian Federation, we now appear to be returning to a situation of stability again in the fuel and energy system. So that attempt was made to attack the refineries, and then it stopped, or at least for the moment, it seems to have stopped. Then we got attacks on the shipping in the Sea of Azov. And undoubtedly, a lot of ships were hit, and a significant amount of damage clearly was done. And the damage, the attacks then spread to encompass more ships in the Black Sea. But again, we don't seem to hear so much about these attacks. It could be that the Russians aren't allowing merchant ships to travel in the Sea of Azov or the Black Sea, but I think that unlikely. I think for far more likely, again, the Russian air defense system has gradually got on top of the situation, certainly in the Sea of Azov and probably in other parts of the Black Sea, which were vulnerable to attack from Ukrainian drones. So, we do still, however, have a drone offensive by Ukraine, but now the major target is not highways, strategic highways, or railway systems, or Crimea, or oil refineries, or ships. It's increasingly now targeting Wildberries warehouses. So, there was a previous attack on Wildberries warehouses in the Moscow region, in the towns of Elektrostal and in Tambov region. And yesterday, last night, we had drone attacks on two more Wildberries warehouses in Krasnodar region, which is, of course, the region, the southern Russian region that adjoins Crimea, and which therefore is closer to Ukraine, and which Ukrainian drones have to travel a shorter distance to reach. Now, the Ukrainians continue to insist that these warehouses, these Wildberries warehouses, are dual-use warehouses, that the Russians store large amounts of military equipment there. Now, to the extent that I can, I've made some inquiries, and my respondents in Russia do not believe that military equipment is stored by the Russian military in Wildberries warehouses. I personally think it is extremely unlikely that they would be. The military in Russia has its own logistics system. Why would it store military equipment in Wildberries warehouses in Moscow region or Tambov regions, far from the front lines, places where the Russians must have assumed until a few weeks ago that their equipment would be safe if it were kept in military facilities, military logistical facilities, which are well protected? It truly doesn't make much sense to me. I've suggested in previous programs that the attacks on the Wildberries warehouses is partly because these are soft targets, easy to hit because they are unlikely to be properly protected. And because of their large facilities, they make large and therefore easy targets. There is probably a further factor at play in that, of course, the warehouses house goods that are being have been sold or are will be sold to various customers in various Russian cities, including Moscow. And of course, Wildberries does this in cooperation with large numbers of Russian small businesses, who are the makers and suppliers to Wildberries of these goods. So these attacks on the Wildberries warehouses do have an economic effect. They put pressure economically on Wildberries. They put pressure, even greater pressure. Wildberries is an enormous operation, but they put at least equal pressure, greater pressure, on the small businesses that rely on Wildberries for their distribution. And of course, they massively disappoint the civilian customers who are not getting these goods, goods from Wildberries that they have ordered. So one can't say that these attacks on the warehouses don't have an effect, but the effect they are going to have is on the civilian economy, not on the development of the war itself. In fact, a UN official has now actually come out and said that if the Wildberries warehouses are merely civilian targets, which, by the way, I believe they are, then the Ukrainian attacks on them would amount to a war crime. Maybe. But anyway, the point I am making is that Fyodorov's great drone offensive has not been as successful, anywhere near as successful, as people imagine. It has done some disruption within Russia. It has led to fuel shortages and queues in gasoline stations. It is now disrupting the supply of goods via Wildberries. But it is not doing anywhere near enough to affect the economy overall or to put political pressure on Vladimir Putin or on the Russian government in general, so as to oblige them to change course, and nor is it doing anywhere near enough to provoke mass opposition to President Putin in Russia in advance of the parliamentary elections in the autumn, such as might also oblige him to change course. So this drone offensive, which, as I said, requires a large investment of resources, has been unsuccessful. So the claims that Fyodorov was successful in what he was doing seem to me, when you and analyse them coldly, well, all that seems to be wrong. But if Fyodorov was engaging in a fair amount of make-believe, I would argue that Sirsky and the general staff, the Ukrainian general staff, and here one must include Zelensky himself, because Zelensky takes a very strong interest in military matters and effectively micromanages the war. Well, in terms of supposed military successes, we now find a complete departure from reality. We've been told for months about how Ukraine has regained the initiative on the battlefield, how it is recapturing ground, how in several months of this year, Ukraine captured more ground than it lost to Russia, how the Russians have been thrown onto the back foot. And, well, I just don't recognise any of this as having any relation to the actual realities on the front lines. I struggle to understand where these successful Ukrainian offensives have happened and what Sirsky, the general staff, and Zelensky have been talking about. Now, the extraordinary thing is that they continued to engage in this myth-making even as Sirsky was sacked. So Zelensky, in his announcement of Sirsky's sacking, heaped praise on Sirsky and said that he was the general who had won the battles of Kiev, Kharkov and Kursk. Well, I would question whether Sirsky really did win any great battle in Kiev in February, March 2022. I don't think there was ever an actual Russian intention to capture the city, at least against resistance, organised resistance. I will agree that Sirsky did conduct a successful offensive in Kharkov in the late summer, early autumn of 2022. To my mind, that is far and away Ukraine's biggest success in the war up to now, and probably it will turn out to be Ukraine's only moment of actual success on the battlefields in this war. And Sirsky was the officer commanding, and no doubt he did play a role in organising that victory. But Kursk? Kursk was a disaster. The idea that anybody should still be spinning the Ukrainian offensive into Kursk region as a success is utterly bizarre. It did not achieve any discernible objective, if the plan actually was, as I believe, to seize the Kursk nuclear power plant. Well, in that case, it obviously failed. The Ukrainians maintained for a few months a presence in Kursk region, which cost them huge numbers of men and equipment. And eventually, with the fall of Suzhou last year, they were forced into a humiliating retreat across the border, with the Russians in hot pursuit, and with the Russians now having consolidated in Sumy region, where they are currently threatening the city of Sumy. So, in what reality can the offensive in Kursk be described as a success for the Ukrainians? And yet, that is what Zelensky said. And, of course, Sirsky was not going to contradict him. But if Sirsky wasn't going to contradict Zelensky on the supposed great victory in Kursk, Sirsky himself went forward and in his statement in response also engaged in fantasy creation. He is handing over to his successor, General Drapaty, a successful, victorious army, which is now on the offensive and which is regaining territory from the Russians and which holds the initiative in the war. This is said just a few weeks, 2 weeks, after the fall of Konstantinovka, the city which has just fallen in Donbass, the effective fall of Lehman, the continued crisis in Zaporozhye region, and with the Russians steadily now expanding the territory that they control in Sumy region and in Kharkiv region. I, again, am unable to see where this territory that the Ukrainians are alleged to have recaptured is. The Ukrainians have conducted certain counterattacks in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk region. Temporarily, these do regain ground, but this is very much part of the ebb and flow of battle. The ultimate story is that eventually they always lose it. So, again, Sirski's claim that he is bequeathing to General Drapaty a successful, victorious army seems to me, once more, to be based on fantasy. And then, of course, we turn to General Drapaty. Now, this is an intriguing story because General Drapaty has been talked up by all sorts of people in Ukraine, and to a certain extent in the West, as a tremendously resourceful, immensely skilled battlefield commander who has allegedly won many battles against the Russians. Again, I'm not sure what these battles are, except that the one that attracts the greatest attention is the supposedly successful counterattack that Drapaty commanded in Kupiansk, which began last year. So, according to this story, the Ukraine, after the Russians captured Kupiansk, the Ukrainians counterattacked under the leadership of General Drapaty and recaptured Kupiansk and defeated and humiliated the Russians. Well, I've never made any secret of my skepticism of large parts of this story, but whatever happened last year and in the early part of this year, there is no doubt any longer that Kupiansk overall is firmly under Russian control and that the Russians are advancing west from Kupiansk. And perhaps even more importantly, the Ukrainian force that was trapped on the east bank of the Oskol River, south and east of Kupiansk, that grouping has been destroyed. Again, what is this victory that General Drapaty is credited with having won? Perhaps he did achieve, if you want to believe this, he did mount some successful counterattacks in Kupiansk, which regained some ground for some period of time. But undoubtedly that was achieved at very heavy cost. And the Ukrainians have lost or are losing all the ground that they recaptured and are now in a worse position than they were in the autumn. So that, it seems to me, is the reality. But, of course, we continue to have the spin and the make-believe, and there's a huge amount of spin still there about General Drapaty. He was known to have difficult relations with Sirski, and that does seem to have made some people like him rather more. And, well, it may be that he is a more talented commander than some of the other commanders we have seen. But anyway, well, I can't see how it's going to make any great difference. Now, a particularly fine comment has been written about this whole affair by Jennifer Kavanagh And it appears in the British centre-left newspaper, Unheard. And I'm going to read what she says. For months, Ukraine's fiercest supporters have argued that Ukraine has turned the tide and is winning the war. But countries that are winning their wars do not remove and replace their defence leaders in the middle of a successful campaign. It might break well-established lines of communication, whilst it could also damage soldier morale and weaken centralised control of the force. Zelensky chose to make these moves. The fact that Zelensky chose to make these moves now suggests that the war may not be going as well as Kiev has publicly claimed. Russian military forces continue to make slow gains in Ukraine's east and are moving closer to the fortress belt that are the crown jewels of Kiev's defences. Those are the cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. Ukraine's vulnerability to deep strikes is also increasing, as it lacks the Patriot missiles to protect civilian infrastructure and populations. Turmoil in the leadership ranks is therefore the canary in the coal mine, indicating that Ukraine's war is going worse than advertised. A new commander, no matter how battle-hardened and accomplished, is unlikely to change the trajectory of the war because he will not be able to overcome the structural challenges that have faced Ukraine since day one. He cannot address Ukraine's lack of manpower, which is as much a function of its smaller population as the diminishing interest of Ukrainian men to join a brutal fight. He cannot address Ukraine's lack of air defences to protect military and civilian targets, which stems from a global shortage. He cannot reverse the slow ebb of Western support, most recently manifested in the EU's inability to agree on a 21st sanctions package, and the growing number of states now drawing back their military or economic support to Ukraine. Drapaty will take control of Ukrainian forces while facing many obstacles. Worst of all, already institutionally weakened by the chaos that preceded him, he will have to deal with the lingering fear that before too long, he may also become a victim of Ukraine's political machine. In other words, at some point, just as his predecessors, Syrsky and Zaluzhny, were sacked, Zelensky will turn on him and sack him also. And this is all, it seems to be obvious. A army that is winning tends to have stability of command. The Russian army, the Russian military in Ukraine, has had stability of command since the winter of 2023, when General Gerasimov took over from General Suravikin as the overall military commander of the Russian forces in Ukraine. Ukraine, in that period, since Gerasimov's appointment, has had three overall commanders: Zaluzhny, Syrsky, and now Drapaty. That does not suggest to me an army that is winning the war or a war that is going well. Well, that's all I'm going to say about General Syrsky. For the record, I thought he was, in some respects at least, a better military man than his predecessor, General Zaluzhny. General Zaluzhny, it seemed to me, was an engaging personality, but somebody who basically coasted along and did what the Americans told him. Sirski was a much more abrasive figure and a rather more difficult and therefore unlikable character. But he did have drive and he did have energy. And though I'm not sure I would agree with this myself, I do know there are some who think that his consistent determination to go on the attack worked well for the Ukrainians in the grinding attrition fighting that took place in Donbass. But anyway, he is now gone. Dripathi, I know much less about. I doubt that he's anywhere near as good as some people are saying. He's certainly no Napoleon, as far as I can see. And frankly, given the realities, I don't see how even Napoleon, a Napoleon in charge of Ukraine's armies now, could make a significant difference. So, what is going on in the war? Well, the Russians continue their attacks on Odessa. And these attacks on Odessa, as I discussed in my program yesterday, now take place with an intensity and a ferocity of a type that, well, I've never seen play out in the war until now, at least from the Russian side. The Russians every day now strike Odessa and the ports around Odessa. And every day, by the way, they give us detailed accounts of what they strike. So, for example, last night, and this I'm taking from the Russian Defense Ministry, they struck what they say were infrastructure facilities at the port of Odessa, the sea commercial port of Odessa state enterprise, used for unloading and storing military cargo and tanks of fuel and lubricants intended for the Ukrainian army, a dry cargo ship and a bulk carrier delivering cargo to the Ukrainian military at the ports of Odessa and Chernomorsk, Novaya Pochta logistics center, this is part of the Ukrainian postal service, used to store military cargo, was also hit in Odessa. And in addition, a Neptune 2 coastal missile system battery, and two launchers and a transport loading vehicle, 25 kilometers northeast of Odessa, were also attacked and defeated. Now, the things that stand out for me there are the attacks on the two ships. Apparently, the ships both destroyed, attacked with missiles. The Russians, of course, always say that these ships were carrying military cargoes. I have no way of knowing one way or the other. The Russians also attacking the facility, the warehouse facility run by the Ukrainian Postal Service. Again, the Russians say that this was used to store military equipment. Again, I don't know one way or the other. Of course, if these ships and these warehouse facilities did not perform military functions, but performed only civilian functions, then, like the Ukrainian Wildberries attacks, the attacks on these facilities would presumably be war crimes. Just saying. But, as I said in my program yesterday, I don't think the Russians any longer care. Their objective clearly is to shut Odessa down. And that, in effect, is what they're doing. In fact, they have shut it down. It is inconceivable that ship owners, commercial or commercial ships, are going to risk sending their ships to Odessa, where the Russians are likely to destroy them. Within the next few days, given the intensity of these Russian strikes, Odessa will cease to be a functioning port. And of course, it may have already ceased to be that already. If the Russians sustain attacks on Odessa at this level over the next few weeks, even after shipping has stopped going and leaving Odessa, then I think we are entitled to see this as something further. The Ukrainians have already been obliged to evacuate most of the population from the city of Kherson on the west bank of the Dnieper River. The strikes on Odessa, I have to say this, have something of the look to me of the same thing. Just as the strikes on the city of Kherson look to be preparations for some kind of military operation to recapture the city of Kherson, preparations for a military offensive that probably will not take place very soon, just saying, maybe in the spring of next year, but being prepared now. So it seems to me the same is true for Odessa. If 2027 turns out to be the year when the Russians capture Zaporozhye and begin an advance along the Black Sea coast of Ukraine, well, I would not be surprised. And at that point, we will definitely see that all of these attacks are part of this. But anyway, the Russians continue to hammer Odessa and Ukraine's other Black Sea ports, and they do so relentlessly, day after day, night after night. No city in Ukraine, not Kiev, has been on the receiving end of such a hammering as Odessa has been over the last few weeks. And remarkably, almost no response internationally about any of this. Western governments choose to say nothing about it, probably because they know there is nothing they can do. The United States government is choosing to say nothing about it. The Turkish government, which you would think would be particularly concerned, is saying nothing about it. Perhaps they all saw how tough the reaction of the Russians were to the protest they received from India, which I discussed in my program yesterday. And the West now realizes that it won't make any difference. And I can't help but think that one of the reasons why this hammering of Odessa gets so little attention in the West is, again, because it contradicts the narrative of the last few months of Russia being on the back foot, of Ukraine having regained the initiative, and above all, of Ukraine being successful against Russia in the sky. So anyway, that is one of the things that is going on. The Russians continue to attack, of course, all sorts of targets in eastern and central Ukraine. They continue to go after the gas filling stations, for example. But also there have been significant developments on the front lines. According to various reports, the Russians have made another big advance northeast of Orekhov in Zaporozhye region. There's said to be a village called Danilovka, which the Russians have now completely encircled. The Russians have also now apparently begun the battle for Alexeya Druzhivka, one of the satellite towns of Kramatorsk that lies immediately to the north of Kramatorsk. There's said to be already fighting going on in that place, and there have been statements of increasing alarm about it from Ukrainian war reporters. The Russians continue to squeeze the Ukrainians out of the salient that the Ukrainians occupied east of Konstantinovka and west of Chasiv Yar. And the Russians are converging on the territory of Nikolaevka and of the Slavyansk thermal power plant. And there are again reports that Russian units, the Russian soldiers, have infiltrated onto the territory of the Slavyansk thermal power plant, and that fighting is taking place there. So all of this continues, and also reports of more Russian advances westwards from Kupiansk, and most dramatic of all maybe, talk of more increasingly rapid Russian advances in Kharkov region. The small town of Beli Kolodias, which is being fought over, and which the Russians say they control around a third of, the Ukrainian garrison in Beli Kolodias looks as if it's been essentially surrounded. So the situation on the ground continues to be very difficult. What tends to happen in this war is that the pressure suddenly builds, and then suddenly a whole lot of populated centres tumble one after the other under Russian control. We saw that in 2024, the autumn of 2024, when in rapid succession, Selidovo, Kurakovo, Uglodar, and other places fell under Russian control. And we saw that last year with Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, and we're seeing it again this year with the fighting that's taking place in Donbass. My sense is that the Russians are now extremely close to the city of Kramatorsk, the main city of the Slavyansk, the biggest city of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk conurbation. General Gerasimov, the Russian commander, about a couple of days ago, said that the Russians are just 5 kilometers from Kramatorsk. I believe the Russians have now moved even closer. They have not yet entered Kramatorsk. Usually with the Russians, there is a period when they reach the boundaries of a town and they consolidate around it, and then small groups of Russian soldiers infiltrate into the town from various places, occupy positions. The overstretched Ukrainian defenders can't find them all, and gradually this force builds in strength until the Ukrainians are overwhelmed by it. I suspect that something very like this scenario is also going to play out in Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. And as happened also in Pokrovsk, where the Russians managed to get total control of the supply roads, mostly using drones. I suspect the same will happen with the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation as well. The reports say that Syrsky, in one of his last decisions as Ukraine's military commander, has been redirecting all the reserves that he has left, that he had left, to try to hold Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and that both towns are now filled with soldiers, Ukrainian soldiers. So, compounding the problem of the fall of these towns will be the fact that probably large numbers of Ukrainian troops will be trapped inside them, as basically happened in Pokrovsk, and we will be seeing in the end a major debacle, a major defeat for the Ukrainian military. There are some claims, events in Ukraine, the invaluable Substack site is a good place to go and to read them. There are some claims that General Drapaty told President Zelensky that he did not want the post of overall military commander that Syrsky had. That though he and Syrsky did not get on with each other, Drapaty preferred to continue to do what he was doing. Given the daunting, all but impossible job that Drapaty has now been handed, it's not difficult at all to understand why. Anyway, the war in Ukraine will go on. The Ukrainian drone attacks will also go on, though I tend to agree with those who have the view that they will abate anyway, because Ukraine is now going through its stockpiles of drones. And though drones are relatively easy to make, Ukraine and its European allies can't keep up with the rate at which drones are being used. So I tend to agree with those who think that the drone offensive will abate. But of course, I don't believe that it will ever end entirely. Whereas the Russian offensive in the sky will continue, as will the Russian advance in Ukraine and eventual capture of Donbass and eventual greater offensives that the Russians will likely do in Ukraine's Black Sea coast as well. Anyway, that's my own take about the situation. We'll see what happens over the next few days. But I noticed that even as I have been making this program, the Russian Defense Ministry has now provided us with further information about yet more attacks on Odessa and on the ports of Odessa. The latest report reads as follows. I'll read it. Again, it gives a sense of the intensity of the Russian air offensive against Odessa. During the day, this is, you know, in daylight, the previous report that I read out earlier in the program described Russian attacks on the port of Odessa last night. Over the course of today, the Russian armed forces continue to launch strikes at ports of Odessa and vessels, as well as logistics centres involved in the interests of the Ukrainian army. Ground and air-based high-precision weapons and drones were used. A dry cargo ship, during unloading cargo intended for supply to the Ukrainian army, the port infrastructure of the logistics centre used for storage of military cargo, as well as tanks of fuel and lubricants in the port of Chernomorsk were attacked. Port infrastructure used for unloading and storing military cargo in the port of Odessa was attacked. A dry cargo ship and bulk carrier delivering cargo to the armed forces of Ukraine at the port of Odessa were attacked during the sea crossing. In other words, they're not yet reached Odessa. They were sailing towards it. In addition, three depots with unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, intended for supply to the Ukrainian military, were hit by attacks, drones in Odessa and Molodyezhnoye, 10 kilometers southeast of Odessa. So Russia is striking at Odessa day and night. It is a relentless campaign on a scale that we have not seen at any point in this war up to now. And it is absolutely a case of the Russians taking off the gloves and striking Odessa in ways that they have never done previously. So that's the situation in the conflict in Ukraine. Now, the other conflict in the Middle East continues. There's been a lot of discussion about what American options might be. There's also a lot of discussion about Iranian plans. It's been pointed out by people like Larry Johnson and the blogger, who's probably Russian, called Amerikanets, both of whom write for on Substack. Larry Johnson's blog is Sonar21, of course. Amerikanets' blog calls itself Amerikanets. Anyway, they both talk about debasification, the fact that the Iranians have basically driven the Americans out of their bases in the Persian Gulf, that those bases have been rendered, in effect, unusable, that the American attempt to establish a center for their air campaign against Iran in Jordan has been rendered unusable as well, and that the Pentagon is now gradually withdrawing U.S. air assets to Israel, hoping that they will be better protected there by the Israeli air defense system, which, however, as we have seen in the past, has problems. And in the meantime, there's been a lot of hand-wringing in the American media about the astonishing effectiveness and accuracy of the Iranian missiles, and much speculation again about the assistance that Iran might be getting from China and Russia. Now, about the assistance Iran is getting from Russia, about that I have absolutely no doubt at all. Just to say, I am certain that it is happening. I didn't, for the record, discuss this with anybody in Russia. That obviously is deeply classified information. But I've no doubt that the Russians are providing Iran with satellite data, guidance data, and I've no doubt that the Russians are providing Iran with technology to increase the accuracy of their missiles and drones. And in fact, and for the record, as you will see if you go back over my various programs that I made in March, I have received information from sources that exactly that has indeed been happening. And as I said, there's hand-wringing about this and huge amounts of recrimination about the fact that the Chinese and the Russians might be providing help to Iran. And there's a ponderous article in National Review, one of the most fervid neocon publications saying that the fact that the Russians and the Chinese are backing Iran shows how high the stakes in the Iran war have become and how terrible and wicked of the Russians that is. I have to say that I find all that very strange. I mean, the United States has been assisting Iran, oh, sorry, Ukraine, to conduct first missile and then drone strikes deep inside Russia. We have had endless articles now, especially in the American media, about the role that the CIA is playing in conducting the drone offensive, the Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia. We read about how Hornet drones developed by Eric Schmidt of Google have been supplied by the United States to Ukraine and were used in the attacks on the Novorossiya Highway and probably on the ships in the Sea of Azov. And yet, somehow, it is astonishing and shocking that the Russians should be providing exactly identical help to the Iranians. It does seem to me that some people do need to be realistic about these things and put aside this extraordinary sense of entitlement they have about what the United States does, just to say. But anyway, putting all that aside, there is increasing talk about how the United States does not have a coherent strategy. Pete Hegseth's latest testimony to Congress will have, I think, for many people, reinforced those doubts. John Bolton, Trump's arch neocon, former national security advisor, has also written a piece in the Daily Telegraph in which he too says that the war is not going well and that there doesn't seem to be a coherent plan. His plan, by the way, is to do more of the same, just to say. But I was alarmed to read in, I think it was Foreign Policy, a US official say that there is now rising, growing talk within the United States about the inevitability of eventually using ground troops, that this is the only way that the United States can achieve its objectives against Iran. Well, on the Duran, we have been saying that for some time. I think that the plan would be a disastrous mistake. It would lead to an ever greater and bigger debacle. But it seems that it is indeed, just as we feared, now being talked about. Anyway, the point is that the Strait of Hormuz is closed. It's not fully clear what's happening with the Red Sea, whether the Houthis have indeed acted on their threat and have closed the Red Sea to shut to Saudi tankers. But it's clear that the situation in global energy markets is becoming tight again. Oil is now said to be trading once more at $95 a barrel, and there's apparently growing shortages of certain types of refined fuels, particularly aviation fuel and diesel. And I, in many programs, have been discussing the apparently critical situation that is developing in Europe over natural gas, that the reserves of natural gas in Europe are extremely low for this time of year, and that the Europeans are not obtaining from the Americans the supplies of LNG that they need to fill up the reserves because they're in a bidding war with Asian buyers who have deeper pockets. And, well, I've been puzzled up to now that this isn't getting greater attention, but at last it has. So an article has appeared in the Financial Times at the very, is in fact the lead article on the Financial Times as of the time of making this programme. European gas prices approach Iran war highs as traders fret over winter supplies. Notice that it refers to Iran war highs. It avoids discussing Russia and the problems with Russia again. And then the subtitle says heat waves and bidding war with Asian buyers leave market vulnerable to Strait of Hormuz disruption. And then we go on to read, European gas prices have surged by nearly 50% over the past month as heat waves and concern over winter supplies leave the market particularly sensitive to the latest disruption of energy flows through the Strait of Hormuz. And we're told that Christopher Halser, a gas analyst at energy consultancy Rystad, said the market had become more sensitive to the latest escalation in the Iran war, which has slowed traffic through the strait to a trickle as Europe's crucial winter heating season approaches. Back in March and April, we had just come out of winter and demand was low. Now we're running out of time as this year's winter approaches, so the price is reacting. Europe is competing for supplies with Asia, where peak summer temperatures have similarly lifted demand for gas-generated electricity. In recent days, several cargoes of liquefied natural gas have been diverted from Europe to Asian buyers willing to buy to pay higher prices. France is expecting to receive just 13 LNG cargoes in July, according to reporting agency Argus Media, the lowest monthly total in more than 5 years. A further 8 cargoes scheduled to arrive in August have been diverted in the recent days, leaving the country expecting 24 shipments that month. An average LNG cargo carries enough gas to supply about 40,000 homes for a year. And the high cost of gas is also complicating efforts to replenish European storage sites during the summer, when countries typically build reserves ahead of the winter heating season. Germany aims to fill its storage facilities to 70% of capacity by the beginning of November. I should say that that is on the low side. But they are only 45% full. Equinor, the Norwegian energy group that is Europe's largest gas supplier, warned on Wednesday that the region might fail to meet its storage targets before winter, leaving it exposed to sharp price swings when cold weather arrives. It is a vulnerable situation, Torgrim Reitan, Equinor's chief financial officer, told Bloomberg Television. We are very uncertain about how we will enter the winter. Well, maybe so, but it's not as if this isn't a problem I have been talking about for weeks now. Suddenly, people are talking about it. The article in the Financial Times does say that there is less vulnerability. Storage levels have become less critical than in the past. Europe has cut annual gas consumption by about 20% following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, has built additional terminals capable of receiving and regasifying LNG. Well, the 20% reduction is the result of deindustrialization. And the new terminals for LNG are all well and good, but then that depends on Europe receiving that LNG. At the moment, it appears to be going instead to Asia. So anyway, the whole situation altogether does not look good, but you would not know about it if you just took your cue from European governments or from the European Commission. Noticed all of the people that I've commented upon, or who commented upon in this article, are industry people. None of them is a politician or a official of any European government. What they insist on doing instead is pressing forward with further sanctions against Russia and its energy system. They cheer on the Ukrainians as the Ukrainians attack Russian refineries. They seize Russian ships on the high seas. They do, in other words, everything they possibly can to disrupt global energy markets. And then, if there is an energy shortage in Europe and a skyrocketing in the price, of course, it has nothing to do with them. Anyway, on that ironic note, I'm going to finish my program today. Thank you. Apologies again for my weak voice. Hopefully, this cold I'm struggling with will get better. But just to remind you again that you can find all our videos on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.